The event at the San Antonio Museum of Art focuses on your 2001 film Waking Life. And just for those who haven't seen it yet, let me say that the movie follows a young man who seemingly can't get out of this state of lucid dreaming. He's wandering the streets of Austin. He's got these wide-ranging conversations about philosophy and metaphysics that he's having with other people. And the film itself is kind of like a dream, too, because you and this team of animators digitally painted over live-action footage to create a really swirly, cosmic animated effect. And I was wondering, first of all, where did you first come across this animation technique?
It was a couple years before we shot the movie. I had had the idea for the movie, maybe, I'm not kidding, for about 20 years. I'd been thinking about it just as a narrative. I had this kind of series of lucid dreams. Remember, I was 18 years old. So I've been thinking about it just as a story or how to deal with it. But it never quite worked, you know. As a filmmaker, I'm always making films in my head. And that one just never quite took hold. It just didn't. I was trying to capture this dream state, and it just, film is a very literal medium sometimes, kind of blunt, you know, in its reality. And so it was when I saw my buddies, Tommy Pallotta and Bob Sabiston. Bob had, you know, written this software, and he's both an artist and a, you know, software designer. And, you know, this kind of, they called it interpolated rotoscoping, kind of a computer variant of the old animation technique of rotoscoping where you draw over existing imagery. This was just a computer version of it that you could do it on your, you know, your Apple, back then a G3 or G4 with a Wacom tablet. So, mm-hmm. When I saw that technique they were doing, and it was very primitive, just black line drawings over characters they had interviewed. They had working in kind of a documentary realm. But when I saw that technique, I was just like, wow. Something clicked in my head over the next, you know, just short amount of time. I was like, that film I've been thinking about forever, you know, that works if it looks like that, you know. So that was just an instinct I had. So I think it was a good example of technology meeting art and creating some, you know, allowing a story to be told. That's why I'm always excited about technology, you know, as an artist, because it's there to help us, you know, communicate. So it was a good example of that particular, you know, technology allowing this story to be made in a way that I felt communicated the movie. Whereas if it was live action, to me it doesn't work as a movie because I was looking for this otherworldly state, and I think that particular technique puts your brain in that place where you're wondering, is this real? It seems real. It seems like a person talking and mm-hmm. documentary, you know, it feels real, and yet obviously it isn't. It's a drawing. It's a cartoon. So I like that as a headspace, and I found that analogous to maybe the dream state, or certainly the lucid dream state. Dreams you don't usually question when you're in a dream. Only after you wake up do you go, oh, that was all a dream. I should have known that. Well, you know, I'm talking to people who haven't been alive for a long time or in some strange location. I should have known, but you don't question it. But this was all about lucid dreaming, where you do become lucid, you do become aware you're dreaming, and you acknowledge everything around you as a construct, you know, of your imagination, mm-hmm. you know, your sleeping brain. So to me, that was the right form. You know, so much of directing is choosing and deciding form, you know, and how it should look and feel to communicate your content. So it was just a wonderful collaborative process. You know, it was like doing the film twice, shooting it and editing it and then reinterpreting it via all these wonderful artists, you know. So quite an experience, I have to say.
And it's not just animating over it, as you said, but it's very painterly the way it looks, and everything's kind of subtly shifting and moving throughout the frame, and yeah. So that's what gives it that kind of dreamlike state, I think, that you referred to.
Yeah, Bob always talked about this as a way to assist painters, like a new way to paint using a computer. So the people we were working with, by and large, weren't animators. They were just artists, people with their own visual styles. And it also, so much of the film was about individuality. I think one of the themes of it was, you know, what is it to be an individual human, you know? And so we kind of intentionally did not go for a unified look. It was like each character, by and large, you know, an animator did a scene. Several did, more than one. But I like the idea that a new character is introduced into the movie and they would look a little different. They would have a, that scene would have a different style to it than the previous or the one right after, just because, you know, it had that uniqueness. There wasn't a fixed style to the movie. So that, to me, worked, you know, thematically.
Well, you said you had been working on the film or thinking about it for some 20 years. And as you watch the film, it sounds like you're just dropping in on these conversations from time to time. And I'm wondering, how much of the script had you written in your head over those 20 years? And how much, if any, had come out through improvisation with actors?
Yeah, I would say a lot of it came out of, I mean, I'd break it down into thirds. Probably a third was stuff that I had, you know, in notebooks or wrote and was done pretty much as written. A third was rewritten very extensively with a character, someone I cast. And a lot of the people in the movie aren't actors. I would say the majority really aren't, you know, professional actors. In casting, I went back to a process I'd used exactly 10 years before when I was doing Slacker. I was like, forget actors. I just wanted interesting people. So the casting search was, you know, I'd ask people, you know, we were around a lot of academics, you know, at UT, St. Ed's, you know, ACC, a lot of people. But I would just say, you know, who are the most interesting people you know? You know, like give out cards. And so, you know, just a wide variety of people came in. And what I would ask them is like, well, of all the things in the world, what do you figure you know more about than most people? You know, what's your areas of expertise? And if they're like, well, I'm a philosophy professor, I say, well, what do you think about, you know, we were just, well, what area of philosophy? And I'm just picking and choosing, thinking like, oh, they could play this person or that's interesting. It would start the conversation right then. Like, you know, I said, and if it hit on a theme of the movie, I would run with that. And I would generally, that person's material would form the scene where myself as director, you know, orchestrator, you know, mm-hmm. I'm kind of editing with them to make a scene out of their ideas.
Yeah, I was going to say, so, how did you tie all these people together, all these disparate ideas?
Well, it was again, it's kind of an intuitive thing on my part, like what fits the movie. Like, I met a lot of great people who, what they were about, or didn't really fit the movie, so they're not really in the movie. But the people who did, you know, they were talking about something, or I felt their energy fit the movie, or I had a part in mind for them. A lot of the people I had worked with before I knew, and I just knew they could do a certain part. So I would work up scenes around people. And so that would probably be a third, that the character themselves really brought almost all the information and I'm just editing. And I'd say another third would be something scripted that was pretty heavily rewritten in a rehearsal process. So this movie was all about process to me. You know, it was, the movie itself is about process. It kind of becomes, somewhere along the way in Waking Life, the movie almost becomes aware of itself as a movie. I always thought of it as a movie that had its own brain in a way, that the movie itself had its own consciousness. Yeah. And so it's kind of funny, by the end or somewhere near the end, it becomes aware of itself as a movie. And even there's a bit with Steven Soderbergh had told me this story about Billy Wilder, something he had said to Louis Mao about a dream movie not having any commercial value. That was kind of the joke. And so I put that in there. It's something that's on TV that the character watches.
Yeah, that was a really...
the movie even becomes aware of itself as a commodity and one not worth very much in the real world. So I thought that was kind of funny.
You know, the movie also seems to me to be that it's just so full of, like, joy for life, because you have all these thoughts and ideas about, you know, life and dreams and making connections with others. And I felt really jazzed after I saw it. And it felt good to see this movie in the fall of 2001 in the immediate shadow of 9/11. It seemed like a perfect time to really have something like this come along and, you know, no pun intended, you know, wake up your soul, sort of.
Yeah, that's the way it turned out. I mean, what started to me as an end of the millennium kind of movie, it was like I was in my late 30s, you know, and I was contemplating, like, all those kind of existential questions you ask yourself in your late, in your teens and early 20s that you never quite answer. You know, I felt like I'd lived long enough. I was noticing the kind of the circle of life. I was back to some pretty fundamental questions that you never quite answer. You get older, you get that much more, a couple more decades of life experience on this earth, but you never fully answer. You know, these things become even more enigmatic. Life becomes even more ambiguous. But I was really charged by kind of rediscovering kind of my concerns of, as a younger person, but from an older perspective. And so it was fun for me to kind of circle back on this. So the film has this kind of youthful, energetic, inquisitive vitality to it that I think you would get from an undergrad, maybe, who's very excited about and curious about the world and meaning and all that. Because I still feel that in my own life now. That's you know, how one should go through life at all times, I feel. And so the movie, to me, was a big yes movie. I thought that it's positive. It's all these thoughts. To me, it was about the aesthetics of thought rather than answers. It's not a yes-no movie, like I agree or I don't disagree. Or, you know, it wasn't to be judged in that way. It was my only criteria was, well, is it interesting? Mm-hmm. I don't care if it's, some of it's a little hippy-trippy, but I was like, is it interesting? You know, is that provocative thought? I don't care if it's true or false. It's not a true-false test, the movie. It's more just that, you know. So to me, that's a positive thing. That, I saw it as a yes movie, overall a positive thing. And it was funny, on September 11th, we were premiering the movie. We were having our North American premiere at the Toronto Film Festival. Needless to say, that got canceled that night. We were all stuck in Toronto. But something else happened with the movie, and Roger Ebert picked up on it first. He says, it was right at that time, he says, I can't think of another movie more important, you know, this, you know how 9/11 was so fascinating, because absolutely everything had to be seen through the 9/11 perspective. And so somehow people thought, yes, we were, yeah, this kind of searching movie felt right at that moment for a lot of people. So, I mean, whatever. It's kind of interesting the way art does that. You can't help but be a part of its moment, you know, when you see it. But to me, these years later, it's a, you know, it's a different movie probably in that regard. But, you know, at that moment, that was what the air we were all, you know, breathing.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you about one scene in the movie. There's this wonderful scene where you have a cameo and repeat to the film's protagonist, played by Wiley Wiggins, this terrific story that Philip K. Dick told about how he unconsciously channeled the Book of Acts in writing one of his stories.
Right.
And I wanted to ask, why is that story placed in the film where it is?
That's interesting. I mean, at that point, the movie is completely circling back on itself near the end. Wiley's character, the unnamed protagonist, is starting to encounter characters he feels like he's met before. He's arguably several layers, I don't know how many layers deep into this dream he can't get out of. And so he runs into a character played by me who was maybe or maybe not in the boat car with him at the very beginning of the movie. I don't, you know, acknowledge that or remember that. And he actually confronts me with his dilemma. And I've done this in my lucid dream that this story is based on. I finally did confront a character and say, hey, listen, I'm stuck in this dream. Am I dead? I mean, what's going on? You know, I was just like, I can't get out of this dream. Every time I wake up, I realize I'm still dreaming. And this guy woke me up in a way similar to what I did. And I just wake up. You know, this guy in the dream kind of caused me to wake up by, I don't know, you know, it's all going on in my brain. It sounds crazy. But so I wanted that. That's the plot point of that scene. The text of that scene, the Philip K. Dick story, and if for all the Dick fans out there, that's a big moment in his life. You know, the events of, you know, 74 that he's dealt with the rest of his life. You know, he had these. I like that idea that time didn't really exist. You know, that we're all in these moments. And, you know, that's kind of the headspace of the movie. You know, you can't really get a timeline on Waking Life. Like most movies, you can say, oh, that took place over a week or 2 years or 24 hours. Or you can't really put a timeline on Waking Life because it's like you could argue the entire movie takes place in a matter of minutes in a dream state. You don't know. And the movie talks about that, too. So I just thought it was kind of cool. The content of that, a lot of that specific scene came from my friend Kaveh Zahedi, who plays I worked up another scene with him. He's the character who has the holy moment inside a movie theater. The movie that's being showed that Wiley's watching is this holy moment. So that's him. But we had talked about this other thing with Philip K. Dick, and I thought that was kind of perfect to, in a way, sum up the movie and time and mortality, too, because it's getting a little scary there, too. So a lot of people interpret the movie like, oh, yeah, isn't he dead, you know? And I'm like, I don't know, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's let me transition and ask you a little bit about, you referenced how Waking Life used some of the techniques that Slacker did. And it's been almost 20 years since Slacker came out, and not only was that a really highly influential film for filmmakers, but it's a real touchstone for fans and fans of Austin, Texas. And do you see that film as kind of a time capsule of the city before the 1990s, or is the city more or less the same but with, like, shinier buildings downtown?
Yeah. I don't know. Film can't help. That's kind of the magic of cinema. It ages so interestingly. You know, you can watch a silent film, something from 1920, and it's just fascinating to look at because it's a time capsule of humanity at that moment. You know, if it's a, you know, if they're out on the streets, or, you know, it's just, it's a powerful medium that way. So Slacker, not that it didn't specifically set out to document, you know, the physicality of Austin. It was more of a document of a certain spirit of not just Austin, but youth and the kind of a college town mentality. It was personal to me. That's the world I was living in. A lot of these people were friends or people I consider friends. And, you know, it was capturing a mentality. But I think because it's really my only movie that's very Austin specific, it's set in Austin. You know, all my other movies are vaguely, you know, Waking Life, even though I shot a lot of it in Austin, I also shot in New York. I shot a nice section in San Antonio. You know, it's kind of all over the map.
Yeah, I recognize the Riverwalk even amongst the
San
animation.
Antonio. We filmed in San Antonio a little bit. It was just fun. You know, different looks, different. So, but Slacker, very Austin-specific. Austin references, you know, Charles Whitman and the government. And, you know, it in spite of itself, it just sort of captured something about Austin that people find either charming or off-putting, depending on their opinion about Austin. But and just one element of Austin. At the time, people were, you know, it wasn't exactly a Chamber of Commerce piece. People were like, where'd you get all these poorly dressed bums? You know, Austin's a beautiful, you know, you're filming in alleys and downtown. It's kind of ugly, too. You don't really capture the Austin I know, with the lakes and the hills and the, you know, parks, and, you know, there's a beautiful part of Austin that the film has no interest in. And so, it grew into the Chamber of Commerce piece that it captured something else about Austin and just one element of Austin, but one piece of how Austin, I think, does sort of see itself as a very tolerant, open ideas type of community, like a lot of college towns. And I always explain Austin as it's on the continuum of state government. You know, go about a mile north and you hit the campus, and go another mile north, you hit like the state mental hospital. You know, so those three sort of run together, and you really don't know who's who. Academia, mental institution, and state government kind of flow all together. Three big institutions.
Interchangeable.
Yeah, in my mind they are. You know, you'd be sitting at a coffee shop, and you know, there's some graduate students talking, there's a professor talking, and then there's some, you know, schizophrenic who's also brilliant, you know, reciting verbatim some paper he's read. He's just also mentioning that he has a implant, you know, in his head, in his brain or something, you know, so it was always, I like the flow. And then it was all, except if you weren't, you know, some psychopath, you can coexist, you know, if you're not hurting anybody.
Sure.
And it was all okay, you know, everybody's just sort of hanging out. There was a certain non-judgmental tolerance that I have always appreciated about that, the environment, you know, near campus.
Do you still stay in touch with any of the people that you made making that film?
Oh, certainly, certainly, yeah. Yeah, a lot of, made some good lifetime friends and a lot of cohorts, you know, people from that I went on to work with for years. And, you know, a lot of the people, one of the producers of Waking Life was an actor in, you know, Tommy, the animation, one of the guys who was working with Bob on all that animation. He's an actor. He was a college student, you know, so that's a good example of someone I just kept up with and mm-hmm. always appreciated and thought was interesting. And, you know, so no, I made a lot of, that's the great thing. I think that's why I wanted to be a filmmaker instead of just, you know, a novelist or something. I really wanted to mix it up with people. I really enjoyed collaborating with people. I like, you know, I like artistic creation, you know, like that in a group. You know, it's fun.
Well, did you grow up loving movies, you know, or was it something you developed later on, your artistic tendencies?
I'd say I didn't think any different about movies as a kid or even as a teenager than anybody else. I mean, everyone just tends to like movies, you know, they're entertaining, they're fun. It wasn't until I was a teenager that I lived in a small town and, you know, the idea of being a filmmaker wasn't really an option. You know, these are just things that showed up kind of magically out of nowhere. But I think I wanted to be a writer. I really came to film kind of as a college student, started thinking about film a little more seriously. Started watching films and thinking like, wow, there's someone writes those, someone directs those, someone, you know, I started studying theater and it kind of, I got interested in the process. But it took me a while to, in my mind, to realize film was my medium, not theater, not literature, that actually I had films in my head, not these other art forms, you know, so it just took me a while.
Was there a particular picture that where it coalesced and you said, oh, well, somebody actually directs this and somebody writes this and then it gets edited and, you know?
Well, you know, I mean, I knew what a director did. I remember my favorite film. Everyone else in my generation, they're all, so many are like, they can tell you where they first saw Star Wars. I really can't. You know, I don't know where I first saw Star Wars. That one didn't leave a big impression on me. But Annie Hall did. That was the same year. I like that one. Yes, that was my favorite film of 77 as a high school kid. You know, so I can, that's kind of my own. That should have told me something right there. But I remember seeing David Lynch's Eraserhead, my senior in high school, in college I saw Raging Bull. I remember seeing Chinatown at some point. You know, you just see movies that kind of wake you up to the possibilities of the medium. But those aren't the kind of films that make you think you can make a movie. They just kind of blow you away in their art and how they spoke to you personally. But it's seeing independent films, some low-budget indie. Once I was working in Houston, I dropped out of college and I was working offshore. But when I wasn't, I was going to movies. And this was the early 80s. I remember like some of John Sayles' early movies, and it was just the American indie scene was starting to really heat up in that there were distributors, My Dinner with Andre, there were these low-budget films, Chan is Missing, of that era, that I was like, wow, some guy got a camera and made that film for $20,000. That's, you know, Eagle Pinnell's Last Night at the Alamo, I saw in like 84, I think. Mm-hmm. I was like, wow, that started seeming accessible to me. Like, I could get a camera, in which I did. I bought a camera and started just shooting film and editing and really teaching myself all that. I was like, yeah, you can do this yourself, you know? So that's what, it's those kind of films that inspire you, give you a little confidence that maybe you could pick up a camera and do it. You know, it's the same in literature. You read Tolstoy or, you know, you kind of go, wow, that's beautiful. I can't write that beautifully. But you read, there are other authors you can read and go, okay, I can kind of maybe, you know, so mm-hmm. Slacker in its own way became that film for a lot of people. I've met a lot of younger filmmakers or people in the industry said, yeah, I saw that in college, or I saw that, yeah, that inspired me. So I'm like, okay, good. You know, we're all here to inspire one another. So, and that doesn't mean it's the best film ever made. It just seemed accessible. Like, wow, I could do that.
Yeah. You know,
it's just a bunch of people talking. I could get a camera. And in fact, it's actually more than that. But, you know, anything that inspires anyone is okay with me.
Well, let me ask you a question. You said you went to high school and you graduated in the late 70s, and your film Dazed and Confused is set in 1976, last day of school. And I remember when it came out, I was in college at the time, and a lot of my friends and I went to see it and just really loved it. And, you know, there's a lot of good times in the movie, but, you know, one of the things that I think some people don't remember about the film and probably consequently also don't think about as much with their school experiences as well, as there's some really kind of painful moments in the film too. And I was wondering if you could talk about where some of those come from. I mean, there's, you know, paddling and hazing is painful on one level, but, you know, there's a scene where Adam Goldberg's character is really just kind of breaks down crying following this fight at a party. And it was really raw and unexpected. And,
yeah.
And it was really, it was really struck me, you know?
Yeah, I set out to make a really honest teenage movie, you know, with Dazed and Confused. And for me, that, you know, was going to be set in this, you know, one night, and it was going to be a extroverted party evening. It's the last day of school, bunch of people really trying as hard as they can to have a good time. But to be honest about those years with myself, I mean, there's a lot of pain and suffering and anxiety and insecurity and all that. So I really, to me, the film's very bittersweet, and I'm always a little surprised. I mean, it's fine with me that the film is seen as kind of a party movie, like, hey. And I think it's, all I can say is it's kind of like your own life. You remember the fun stuff and you just block out all the bad. But there's plenty of bad in that movie, and I think it's what gives it that extra layer of substance that makes it seem real, is because there's a lot of, I felt it. It was painful for me to make that movie in one way. I would be on the set, and I'd look up, and I was back in 1976. You know, here I am, a freshman in high school, and I was like, wow, I'm so glad I'm out of this. Those weren't necessarily great years, even though I had, you know, as good a high school career as anyone could. I was, you know, pretty good student. I was an athlete. I was, you know, popular, and I had it good. And I think, wow, if I still felt all that, what's everybody else thinking? So, you know. So anyway, there was a lot of it's a dark linings to those clouds. Little youthful sorrows abound, and yet it's still a Valentine to that moment. You know.
Well, and one of the characters that everybody remembers, though, Wooderson of Matthew McConaughey, you know, this guy who graduated and he's still hanging around town hitting on the girls. I want to know, yeah, how many guys like that did you know in real life?
Well, I've run into people all over the country, all over the world, who said they'll just give me the name of that guy at their school. At my school, that guy's name was fill in the blank. And when they mean that guy, just a guy who, those are the best years of his life. And he doesn't really want high school to end. The real world's not that appealing. And younger girls think he's pretty cool, where girls his own age or older think he's kind of a loser. So, you know, it's just... And he is pretty fun and charming in his own way. So I think Matthew made that character his own to such a degree. He just owns that character from now on, I think. It was so fun to work with him and see that come about. It was a much smaller part in the script, but Matthew and I, we just started rocking and rolling together and having ideas, and I'm writing new scenes with him in it, and just we really clicked, you know. He really got it. And when I first met him, he was like, I'm not this guy, but I know this guy.
You know.
Matthew and I bonded. He had, you know, graduated from Longview High School. I was at Huntsville High School, you know, two East Texas boys getting together. We found out years later our dads played on the same college football team at the University of Houston. So we were kind of joined, you know, we had a lot more in common than we even knew. But, he just made that his own, you know.
Well, music plays a big role in that movie, and, you know, your love of music comes through with a film like School of Rock, and I want to know what are some of the bands that you loved growing up as well.
Oh, gosh. Well, with Dazed, I always said that the music was probably the most expressive element of the movie. Like, teenagers can't really express themselves very clearly, but the music does it for you. That's why music means so much to you. It kind of captures your emotions and your feelings and all your angst and exhilaration. And, you know, it's all there in the music.
It's why we make mixtapes for our sweethearts, you know?
Yeah. And so the music was a huge element of them. And, but music, that's how it's been in my own life. I'm just being very personal. Like, those are all songs that meant something to me at that moment. I even said it at that moment, kind of pre-disco, pre-punk moment, just because there was something kind of American rock and roll about it. Even though there's plenty of British and, you know, songs from around the world, there was something kind of rock and roll-y about it that I wanted to capture that moment. So, but music, you know, it's a huge element in my life. And my most recent film, Me and Orson Welles, it's like my favorite music of 1936, 1937 is very specific to that period. So I've always, you know, knowing a lot about music and being a big fan, you know, it's always kind of served me.
And the Newton Boys has a great soundtrack, too, of jazz and you know.
Yeah, that's my most underrated soundtrack. The Newton Boys is what Danny Barnes and Mark Rubin and, you know, it was a lot of research and history and making a period film and then working up all that music was really, really fun. And everybody did a great job on that. I'm so proud of that soundtrack. I still, it's one of mine that I listen to, you know, every now and then.
Well, let me ask finally about Before Sunrise and Before Sunset, because so many people said, "Oh, please ask him about these films." I love them. My wife loves them. I have lots of friends who love these pictures. They're, you know, you have two sides of the same coin here. You have a beautiful romantic first film where two young people are on the verge of discovering themselves and each other and the world. And it's, they're in their youth and it takes place over the course of this one night in Vienna. And then you've got Before Sunset when they're older and they've learned a little bit more about life and taken a few hits and, I don't know, have a bit more cautious view of the world, I guess. And so if you have two sides of the same coin, I'm wondering, is there going to be another coin? Are you going to follow Jesse and Celine every 9 years or so?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, Ethan and Julie and I, we're all pretty bonded at this point. We love each other, love working with each other. So I wouldn't rule it out. We don't have anything on the table right now. But, yeah, it would, to me, one movie's about being in your early 20s and the next is about being in your early 30s. I mean, they're still the same people, but that time element is very fascinating. You know, you accumulate life, you know, life goes on and you're not quite as, you know, there's something great about getting older. You're more comfortable in your skin, but you know, you know, there's also a certain layer depending on, you know, how you handle everything, scar tissue, etc. You know, the inevitable disappointments in life and things that don't work out. And, you know, I don't know. It's kind of bittersweet, but so much of life is. So we were just being very honest with ourselves about being a certain age. And it's different because I'm almost 10 years older than both of them. So I'm looking back a decade, like I'm 32, 33 making Before Sunrise. They're the exact age that they're depicting. So I get kind of a raw emotional feedback from them And I'm looking back 10 years with a little bit of distance, kind of thematically being able to pick and choose and think what resonates with me. So it's a nice little partnership we have going where we all kind of, you know, they're huge contributors. I mean, we kind of all, I had an existing script the first time, but we all sort of rewrote it. We sat in a hotel room in Vienna for 3 weeks and rewrote it, and they added so much to it. And, you know, the second one we three wrote together. So, I mean, they're both directors and writers. So they're fascinating people. I love them both. So I think we'll, you know, it'd be great to work together again. But, you know, can we really have this single disembodied romantic moment? I mean, you know, the second one is, you know, say like 80 minutes of their lives, you know.
Yeah.
The third one, I don't know if we could do that again. It'd have to be something else, a little different maybe.
Well, I got to say, at the end of the second one, too, though, it was such a beautiful ending and perfect that I let out an audible, huh, when it ended, because it was just, I said, of course, this is the way it must be. So.
Yeah, I've heard of people, like, that ending sort of shocked people, but it also kind of, like, I was thinking, I mean, endings are tough, you know. I was thinking, like, someone said the perfect ending is something that is unexpected and yet completely inevitable. And so I'm like, yeah, that's what that is. You feel a little like, oh, it's over. But then it's like, of course it's over. You know, anything after that moment is going to be a different movie.
Yeah.
So it's like someone told me they were sitting in a theater, and right as that moment, someone said, if this movie had any guts, they'd end it right here. And it faded out right then, you know, or something. I was like, you hear something like that and you're proud of it. You're like, yeah, we got guts. We brought it. We'll end it right there.
Did I read it correctly that, you know, speaking of following characters, though, that you're currently working on a project where you're filming a little bit at a time in order to get, you know, a young boy's life over the course of many years?
Yeah, I've had this ongoing longer project. I'm in my ninth year. This will be my ninth year of shooting coming up this, I think, fall or winter I'll shoot again. But I wanted to do a film about childhood, so I couldn't really figure out what point of childhood. Do you do the 400 blows thing where you, you know, 3 days of childhood? Do you, you know, you're so limited. So I had this idea to kind of cover more ground, and it became this kind of experimental idea about time passing and all this. So, you know, just like Waking Life or some of the other movies I've been lucky enough to get made, it's just kind of a crazy idea, and but maybe a new way to tell a story that will work in some strange, in its own way. So I'm trying. I'm two-thirds of the way done, I guess. And I'm kind of following a kid from first to 12th grade, just, you know, his kind of through the public school education, I guess.
And so how do you write it along the way?
Well, I have the architecture for the whole story. I kind of know what's going to happen in every episode. But, each year I get a year to think about it, and I collaborate with the kid in the movie who's growing up, obviously. So I just sort of, you know, feel my way through it every year, think about what's going on at that point in your life, what's important, you know, or what's indicative, or, you know, just what's going on with these characters. You know, he's got divorced parents, and they've got their lives. It's very much about family. He's got an older sister, he's got parents, the family moves, you know, so moves around, you know, it's just life unfolding, you know. No big plan, it's just the way it goes.
Great. Well, Richard Linklater, you've been very, very generous with your time with me today, and so I thank you very much for this. It's been a real treat.
Yeah, good talking to you.